An Israeli minister confirms the secret visit of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to Saudi Arabia, calling it an amazing achievement. Oil production reportedly comes to a halt in the Aramco facility in the Saudi city of Jeddah after a retaliatory missile attack by the Yemeni army. A British drug firm says its coronavirus vaccine, developed along with the University of Oxford, shows an average efficacy of 70% in trials. Greetings and a warm welcome to World News. Good to have you with us. Beginning with our top story, a member of the Israeli Prime Minister's cabinet has confirmed the premier's Sunday trip to Saudi Arabia. Netanyahu's education minister, Yoav Gallant, told the Israeli media that Netanyahu has met with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. The minister called the meeting an amazing achievement, as it's the first one between Israel and Saudi Arabia. Israeli media early reported about the meeting, releasing aviation tracking data of a brief trip of a business jet from Tel Aviv through Saudi's coastal city of Neom. Reports saying that Mossad chief Yossi Cohen was also accompanying Netanyahu. The meeting is seen as the U.S. administration's last-ditch efforts to discuss normalization of relations between Tel Aviv and Riyadh. Political analyst Elijah Magnier says that Israel and Saudi Arabia have had regular contacts for years.
I think it's very far from being an achievement. The relationship between Saudi Arabia and Israel is not new. The contact between the two are very regular since ages. It's coming out now, but it serves different purposes. First of all, in my opinion, I think it is an advert to Neom, mega city that is planned by Mohammed bin Salman. It's a $500 billion plan. It's also a support for Netanyahu's domestic crisis. We saw how one of his aides said, while Netanyahu is making peace, Benny Gantz, the defense minister, is playing politics because Netanyahu is accused of corruption and Benny Gantz wants to open an investigation into the corrupted deal of the submarine and naval deal that Israel did, and Netanyahu has been accused of corruption many times.
Palestinian children continue to pay the price of Israeli attacks. A new report says at least 3,000 children have lost their lives during Israeli military aggression since the year 2000. Ashraf Shannon has more.
Israeli forces have killed over 3,000 Palestinian children since the beginning of the Second Intifada, also known as the Al-Aqsa Intifada, in September of 2000, while tens of thousands of others sustained injuries. The figures were released by the Palestinian Ministry of Information, who pointed to the deliberate killing of Palestinian children by the Israeli military. The Palestinian Ministry of Information added that 123 Palestinian minors have been killed and many more injured ever since U.S. President Donald Trump officially recognized Jerusalem al-Quds as the Israeli capital in December 2017.
Seven children have been killed since the beginning of the current year as a result of the Israeli military assault. At least 3,097 children were killed between the year 2000 and the end of October 2019. The brutality of the Israeli occupation has no limit when it comes to targeting Palestinian civilians, especially children.
Since 2008, Israeli forces waged three wars on the Gaza Strip, killing and maiming thousands of children. During Israel's 2014 war on Gaza, Israeli forces killed over 2,200 Gazans, including hundreds of children, with more than 11,000 people wounded. According to human rights organizations, the Israeli attacks on Palestinians, including children, were systematic and deliberate, and fall under Israel's strategy of using disproportionate and excessive force against civilians.
Israel has demonstrated zero accountability to crimes perpetrated by soldiers, and this continues to encourage it to to perpetrate more crimes and use disproportionate, excessive and lethal force against children and civilians.
No Israeli force has ever been put to trial in crimes perpetrated by its soldiers due to the protection it enjoys from the United States.
Despite Israel's grave violations of international law, Palestinian children continue to suffer due to international apathy. Rights groups demand that Israeli war criminals be brought to justice. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
The Yemeni military says it has targeted an Aramco oil distribution station in Saudi Arabia. Army spokesman Yahya Saria says the targeted facility is located in the Red Sea city of Jeddah. It says the attack was a legitimate response to what are described as Saudi crimes and aggression against Yemen. The spokesman warned foreign companies working in Saudi Arabia to exercise caution as those operations will go on. Authorities in Riyadh have refrained from reacting to the news. Oil production in the facility has reportedly come to a halt. I talked to political commentator Jason Aruha, and he says that the Yemeni army's retaliatory attack indicates the fact that the war has become unwinnable for Riyadh.
National budget is one of them. How long do they want to continue dumping resources into what is essentially a failed effort? Nothing good for Saudi Arabia has materialized out of this. I mean, they've even suffered a significant amount of damage to their own oil production from retaliatory strikes from the Yemenis. They haven't made a single dollar off of this entire endeavor, which is generally what imperialist war is about. It's about getting hold of resources, access to markets, cheaper labor, etc. But none of this has materialized for them. This entire endeavor has been one monumental loss. The other factors which are particular to this case are the political will to continue, you know, this in this entire war. I mean, it's all been for nothing. And that's eventually going to take its toll politically on the royal family, the political establishment, etc. How much are they willing to throw away, and how much of their ego, or how much are they going to attempt to save face? Because this is very humiliating. This is something they thought was going to be a quick in and out job, and they would have Yemen, but it's been going on for years now, and they've made no significant inroads. They've not really made any major capturing, so it's really a question of whether or not the Saudis are really going to just eventually admit defeat. And I don't think, given their previous efforts, that it's coming anytime soon.
A new coronavirus vaccine developed by British drug firm AstraZeneca and Oxford University has shown 70% effectiveness in trials. A statement by AstraZeneca and Oxford saying that the results range between 62 and 90% efficacy depending on the vaccine dosage. The company says it'll look to develop up to 3 billion doses of the vaccine next year if it passes the remaining regulatory hurdles. Britain's planning to start a COVID-19 vaccination before Christmas to bring life back to normal after Easter. Several companies, including Moderna and Pfizer, have already developed vaccines with announced effectiveness of above 90%. China has reported local coronavirus cases in two major cities, raising concerns of another outbreak in that country. In Shanghai, cases were detected among several workers of Pudong Airport. Health authorities are conducting mass testing there. The reemergence of local cases in the northern city of Tianjin has also prompted the authorities to run large-scale testing while moving groups of people to quarantine zones. Tianjin reported 10 local infections recently. Neighboring India has also confirmed more than 44,000 new cases. The figure has brought a tally to 9.14 million in the world's second hardest hit country after the U.S. That's while in Australia's Victoria, normalcy is restoring as no new infection has been reported there since the beginning of November. Uncertainty continues around the U.S. presidential election as President Donald Trump refuses to concede, while his Democratic rival Joe Biden is preparing to assume office on January 20th. A short while ago, my colleague has discussed that issue with our guests in the News Review program.
Welcome. The projected winner of the U.S. presidential election, Joe Biden, goes ahead with his preparations to assume office on January the 20th, while President Donald Trump continues to dispute vote counts. In an interview with ABC News, Biden's chief of staff, Ron Klain, said the former vice president will name his first cabinet picks on Tuesday. Klain didn't say which posts would be announced, but Biden says he has already decided on the Treasury Secretary nomination. In a tweet on Sunday, Trump repeated his claim about, quote, massive and unprecedented fraud in the November 3rd election. This comes despite a series of legal setbacks for Trump, the latest of which happened on Saturday when a Pennsylvania judge threw out the president's complaints about mail-in ballots in the state. Joining us for more on that is Mike Billington, the member at the Executive Intelligence Review, and we also have Nick Ayala, co-editor at Anti-Conquista. Welcome. Mike, I'll begin with you. Biden's transition team appears to be pressing ahead with a view to taking office despite Trump's ongoing legal battles. What's your thoughts there?
Well, the Democrats and the Washington Post and the New York Times and CNN and so forth, the same people who gave us the Iraq War, the Libya War, and the Syria War, are lying, as they did throughout 4 years of the Russiagate hoax and the fake impeachment, to simply ignore the Constitution and declare through the media that Biden is the winner, when, according to the Constitution and the laws, nobody has yet been chosen as a winner. And in fact, the evidence of fraud in this case are so enormous, so overwhelming, that every news report that you see that says unsubstantiated claims and so forth are ludicrous. In fact, most of the Democrats over the last 4 years have openly complained about the vulnerability of both the voting machines and mail-in ballots, and yet when it came time to try to, they failed to remove Trump, who they despise because he wants to end the endless wars given to us by Bush and Obama, and are working hand in hand with the British to overthrow the Trump administration for the last 4 years through this fake Russia story, are now using vote fraud at a massive scale. And of course, the same media backing up the lies over and over and over again, making people somehow believe. And in terms of the Republicans who are calling on Trump to step down, keep in mind that Trump is not really a Republican or a Democrat. He won the Democratic nomination despite the fact that he despises the Bush crowd and the Cruises and the Rubios, the warmongers, the neocons. He appealed directly to the vast majority of American working people and farmers to end the wars, to rebuild the American economy, to be friends with Russia and friends with China after he solved the trade deal. And now you have one of the most massive operations run again by the British, by the way. The voting machines called the Smartmatic company, run by Lord Mark Malik Brown, George Soros's closest friend, who have run regime change wars all over the world, the Philippines, Georgia, Ukraine, and in fact are involved in a regime change effort against your country. These are the people who are now running the regime change against the United States itself, straight from Lord Malik Brown, a top British imperial asset, and one who is, in fact, has been caught repeatedly running regime, caught, in fact, he brags about running regime change, and now they're trying to do the same in the U.S. with the full complicity of the media. We have to wait until the constitutional laws of elections are carried out. It may be that the courts in the long run, and believe me, the local courts are not going to be where this is decided, but in the Supreme Court. And it may be that they find there's no evidence, but the overwhelming evidence is that this was the most corrupt election in the history of the United States.
Was it, Nick? Mike raises important points there. There is a lack of, you could say, a lack of trust in the establishment, in the intelligence, in the media. For example, the Iraq War and everything that happened there with regards to intelligence over weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah, it's understandable that, you know, people are coming out against the idea that Joe Biden won the election because, you know, for the last decade, even more so last few decades, the establishment media, particularly the liberal establishment media, has done nothing but churn out lies. We saw for the last 4 years they spewed some Russiagate conspiracy, and then before that you had lies about Iran, and then you had before that you had lies about Iraq. So it makes sense that there's distrust within the, or against the established media. That being said, the current conspiracy theory pushed by Trump and Giuliani and many of his lackeys is probably far more baseless than any of the conspiracy theories pushed by liberal media. What we're witnessing now is probably one of Trump's greatest scams. He's raising thousands and thousands of dollars, millions of dollars from his base, taking their money in order to run a legal defense scam, which isn't going to get anywhere, as the other commentator has already said. There's a good chance it's not going to go anywhere, and it essentially is, most of the cases have already been thrown out. And it's a good way for Trump to stay relevant.
With yourself having lived in the United States and having seen what you've seen, is it not hard for you to believe that this election could have been rigged?
To be quite honest, I with the evidence and the claims that are being made by Giuliani and by Trump's team, it's hard to believe that this election was rigged in such a massive way that Trump could win millions and millions of votes back and, potentially win the election.
Well, if we put Trump and Giuliani aside, is it still not hard to believe, considering everything that America's been through and the lies, well, the arguments that it presents to the international community without any evidence that this election was rigged?
I mean, yeah, it could be. I mean, of course, my argument would be that the U.S. is not so much of a democracy as it is an oligarchy. So really what's happening is, the capitalists get to choose who wins and who loses. Yes, the elections are always rigged. The primary was rigged. Both the Democratic primary was rigged, and the Democrats were the ones who rigged the primary against certain progressive candidates, like Bernie Sanders. And there's, always a potential that there's fraud and voter fraud, or election fraud, because the chances of voter fraud are less likely, but the chances of election fraud are more likely, that took place. But, even in those cases, it's not significant enough to make a difference. And I think the overarching message should be that no matter who wins, the U.S. people are going to lose. And no matter who you vote for, your opinion is most likely not going to matter. I mean, look, we have a U.S. democratic system which is still allowing gerrymandering, which still allows for voter suppression, for one polling station open in an entire state, creating massive lines.
Right.
They could care less about what voters think or say. The election is always going to be rigged in one favor or the other. It's just a matter of who rigged it better.
Let me thank our guests, Mike Billington, the member at the Executive Intelligence Review, and Nick Ayala, co-editor at Anti-Conquista, joining us. And thank you for staying tuned to this edition of the News Review.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq. Greetings be upon them, and which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week.
What kind of government is the French government? The same government offered the most help to a bloodthirsty wolf named Saddam. Of course, we cannot say that it offered more support than other governments. It was one of the main supporters of Saddam in that war. It provided that bloodthirsty wolf with advanced planes and advanced equipment, and they were not ashamed of doing it as they have acknowledged it. This is related to their behavior towards terrorists and the like. But you have also witnessed how they treated their people during the Saturday Yellow Vest demonstrations held last year. That is while they claim to be interested in freedom, human rights, and other such values. I believe that these are the two sides of the same coin. In other words, defending that act of cultural savagery and the criminal action taken by a cartoonist is one side of the coin, and the other is defending and helping the Munafiqeen and Saddam. These are the two sides of the same coin.
Your light and love, policy, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Well, such courses of action have been repeatedly adopted in European countries and in the US. The incidents related to insulting the Holy Quran and the Holy Prophet have frequently occurred in Western countries, in both the US and European countries. But such incidents cannot damage the honor, magnificence, and greatness of the Holy Prophet of Islam in the slightest manner. It is completely clear that the enlightened personality of the Messenger of Mercy cannot be damaged with these actions. By Allah's favor, this sun shines more brightly on a daily basis. Just as the thugs in Mecca and Taif could not erase the name of the Holy Prophet of Islam, despite all the efforts that they made, these excellencies will not be able to damage the Holy Prophet either. However, one can understand a point from this incident, that these courses of action show the dark nature of the Western civilization.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Thank you. on the news line.
Russia says the United States has deceived Moscow, and the international community after it conducted an advanced intercontinental missile interception test. Russia's foreign ministry says the exercise used technology that is part of the Aegis Ashore missile defense system, which the Pentagon had assured the Kremlin was not aimed at Russia's long-range capabilities. A Russian foreign ministry spokesperson has described the development as quote-unquote a new confirmation of the dangerous and destabilizing character of Washington's anti-ballistic missile strategy and quote obvious anti-Russian orientation. Maria Zakharova says the test proved the falsity of American statements saying quote for many years, America assured us that the interception of Russian ICBMs by American standard systems, including this modification, is technically impossible. There are fears the test risks paving the way for Russia testing similar technologies against America's intercontinental ballistic missiles. Moscow has already stated that it reserves the right to take the necessary response measure. On Monday, the U.S. military used a new advanced technology to fire, for the first time, a missile from a warship which downed an ICBM. Previously, the U.S. had promoted the weapons system as being limited against short and intermediate-range missile threats. Russia says this is direct evidence and a concrete example of how Washington manipulated public opinion of its country, lied to its international partners, and justified its actions in the international arena with far-fetched pretexts. Following the collapse of the INF and before the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, the only remaining U.S.-Russian nuclear arms control agreement, New START, is also, as things stand, set to expire early next year. Moscow says it hasn't closed the door on negotiations to extend the agreement, formerly known as the New Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. The projected U.S. presidential election winner, Joe Biden, has previously said he will explore the treaty's extension without conditions. However, bilateral relations between the two countries have always been on very shaky grounds. Analysts say the latest American missile test will only escalate military tensions. Amid Russia's worsening relations with NATO, it could not have come at a worse time. Questions have been raised as to whether the U.S. may use the system against Russian military interests. The weapon used to down the ICBM, the Standard Missile 3 or SM-3, is part of the Aegis Ballistic Missile Defense System. Moscow has long suspected the system to be a major pathway to a U.S. global missile shield to undermine Russia's military power. The SM-3 missiles have also been deployed close to Russian soil, in Poland and Romania. Moscow says it has repeatedly warned it would take similar measures to ensure national security and maintain a strategic stability. Essentially, that means more sophisticated weapon systems deployed by the adversaries, while suspicions between the U.S. on the one hand and Russia and China on the other spiral out of control.
Bahrain's top diplomat on an official visit to Israel, breaking a long-time taboo. Foreign Minister Abdullatif Al-Zayani landed in Israel on Wednesday. His controversial trip this week marks the first such visit to Israel by any official from the tiny Persian Gulf Kingdom. Al-Zayani's trip coincides with a visit to Israel by America's top diplomat Mike Pompeo. The Bahraini delegation went on to occupy Jerusalem al-Quds. The top Bahraini diplomat sat down for talks with senior Israeli officials, including his counterpart Gabi Ashkenazi and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The U.S. Secretary of State was apparently there to facilitate the controversial rapprochement. Al-Zayani's trip, which has angered the Palestinians, is part of a U.S.-backed push to normalize ties between the two sides.
It is obvious that the Trump administration wants to make sure that the normalization process and the what they used to call the deal of the century will be very crucial and strong before they get away from the power in January. So they are doing marathonian steps so that everything will be on the ground and will be very much clear laid out.
Palestinian groups denounced the trilateral meeting between the U.S., Bahrain and Israel as a clear attack on the rights of the Palestinian people. The Palestinians want all Arab nations to refrain from establishing ties with Israel until the Israeli occupation is over and a Palestinian state becomes a reality. But as part of a U.S. brokered initiative, Bahrain and its Persian Gulf neighbor, the United Arab Emirates, signed normalization accords with Israel at the White House in mid-September. Sudan has also agreed to normalize ties with Israel as part of a deal that will guarantee much-needed U.S. financial aid. Israel has escalated its violations in the occupied territories over the past years. For instance, it has stepped up settlement construction on occupied lands. The regime has also stepped up demolition of Palestinian homes. So far this year, nearly 700 structures have been razed to the ground across the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem al-Quds. The UN says that number is more than the figure in any full year since 2016. Palestinians have widely blamed the worsening situation on policies pursued by the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. The American president makes no secret of his extremely pro-Israel stance. Trump took the American support for the regime to a whole new level by moves such as recognizing Jerusalem al-Quds as Israel's capital. Palestinian groups now say the U.S.-backed push to normalize ties between several Arab states and Israel is further emboldening the regime. How can Palestinians now trust the U.S. as it loudly brands itself as a mediator between them and Israel? Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today as several Arab states are abandoning the cause and normalizing their ties with Israel. Palestinians say these Arab states are stabbing them in the back. Palestinians know all too well that their options are very limited at the moment. As many governments refuse to pressure the Israeli regime, the people of Palestine are hoping popular grassroots campaigns against Israel will one day change things for the better.
After months of chaos and hundreds of thousands of deaths worldwide, an end to the crisis triggered by the deadly coronavirus pandemic could be within reach. U.S. biotech firm Moderna has announced its experimental vaccine against COVID-19 was 94.5% effective. The announcement would make it the second major breakthrough in worldwide hunt for an effective vaccine. Moderna has announced that its newly developed vaccine would pose no significant side effects.
At the end of this trial, if the efficacy dropped down to 80% or even 70%, this is still really a very good result and a really strong reason to be optimistic to have a vaccine and very soon vaccine.
According to the data provided by the company, its vaccine was given in two doses 28 days apart, and the preliminary results are based on 95 volunteers of the 30,000 who fell ill with COVID-19. Just last week, U.S. drug maker giant Pfizer, along with its German partner BioNTech company, announced the invention of a separate effective vaccine against the deadly virus. According to scientific reports, a key advantage of Moderna's vaccine is that it does not need ultra-cold storage like Pfizer's, making it easier to distribute.
Oh, yes, certainly. I mean, these are really good results, although they are interim results, early stages data, but yet these are really exceeding the expectation, because what we expected in the scientific community and also the regulatory bodies were that we will have a coronavirus vaccine around 60 to 70% effective, and this vaccine, both of the vaccine, Moderna and Pfizer results, are more than 90%.
The vaccines are viewed powerful tools to fight a pandemic that has infected 54 million people worldwide and killed 1.3 million. The news also comes at a time when COVID-19 cases are soaring, hitting new records in the United States and pushing some European countries back into lockdowns. Next year, the U.S. government could have easy access to more than 1 billion doses just from the two vaccine makers, more than needed for the country's 330 million residents. Other European nations are expected to have easy access to the vaccines. Head of the World Health Organization has hailed the rapid progress towards a COVID-19 vaccine, but insisted that every country had to reap the benefits from the vaccines. Never in history has vaccine research progressed so quickly. We must apply the same urgency and innovation to ensuring that all countries benefit from this scientific achievement.
And I can announce that we have today secured an initial agreement for 5 million doses of the Moderna vaccine.
Tedros Adhanom has said other countries could not wait for bilateral agreements to get the vaccine since the process could take years to negotiate. There are now concerns that richer countries could monopolize the distribution of the vaccine. Western nations have already ordered millions of the doses of the vaccine, potentially leaving poorer countries in Africa and Asia without supply for years to come. It's feared relatively wealthy nations will likely be able to vaccinate their entire populations.
The first agreement that we reached with the U.S. government was for an order of 100 million doses. So we anticipate to be able to ship up to 20 million of those 100 million before the end of the year. So we are making product, as you know, every day and stockpiling it. And assuming we get the green light from the FDA, I would say sometime in December, I'm sure General Perna from Operation Warp Speed will be ready with the trucks to load the product and to distribute it in the U.S. via the CDC guidelines.
The EU has already ordered 200 million doses of Pfizer's vaccine, while the UK has ordered 40 million doses. People in low-income countries could be waiting until 2024. Drug-making companies could also benefit profusely from the world's deadliest pandemic in recent memory. Pfizer and BioNTech could make $13 billion from coronavirus vaccine.
A mega free trade pact came into existence a few days ago. The Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership has been described as the largest free trade agreement in history. 10 Southeast Asian countries, as well as China, South Korea, Japan, Australia, and New Zealand, formed the brand new trading bloc. The agreement was signed on the sidelines of the annual meeting of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations on Sunday, after nearly a decade of negotiations. What makes the RCEP very important is its sheer size, nearly a third of global economy. The world's largest trading bloc has become a reality as the international community is grappling with the devastating economic impact of the coronavirus pandemic. It is hoped that the RCEP will spur economic recovery from the downturn caused by the virus. Meanwhile, the new agreement, which excludes the United States, is widely viewed as a geopolitical victory for the world's second largest economy, China. Observers believe it will boost China's influence in the region at a time when the U.S. is taking a tough line on its arch economic rival.
I can't emphasize enough how important the free trade agreement is for the reshaping of international political and economic relationships. And this will clearly strengthen China's hand in trying to keep the United States from its somewhat hostile incursions into what the Chinese government considers its territories.
The RCEP is described by some experts as a major win for multilateralism and free trade, despite America's withdrawal from many international agreements. The new free trade agreement is often compared to the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal that U.S. President Donald Trump defiantly tore apart soon after he took office. The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has been particularly confrontational in its economic strategy. The White House has implemented protectionist policies like no other U.S. administration. It has taken a tough line on China, blaming it for a large part of America's trade deficit. The U.S. is also engaged in trade conflicts with other major players, like the European Union. But Trump's protectionist agenda is not preventing the rest of the world from pursuing free trade at different levels. The Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership is proof that the world prefers multilateralism.
That will give extraordinary support to the multilateralization of international trade in a way that perhaps is not contemplated in the concept of bipolarity or even in the notion of globalization as it was being considered in recent years.
Even America's close allies like the EU are engaged in free trade negotiations. Trump's protectionist agenda may eventually backfire, because as a growing number of countries sign free trade deals, American exporters may soon find themselves losing ground to international competitors. But who knows what direction America will take in the future? Trump will probably have to leave the White House in January, and that does not give him enough time to complete his America First project. The projected winner of the U.S. presidential election, Joe Biden, will face many dilemmas exactly because of Trump's controversial policies. Biden's presidency will probably mean a more traditional U.S. role on the world stage. He could bring back America from the brink of a full-blown trade and military conflict with China. But he cannot abruptly do away with Trump's protectionism to join free trade deals. Because right now, many Americans would see any such decision as throwing away U.S. jobs.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
For years, it had been assumed that superior skills in facial recognition could be taught and would help those working in police and security agencies to make more accurate judgments about a person's identity. While this is true up to a point, research has found that the remarkable abilities demonstrated by super recognizers can't be learned. Researchers think they are coded into our DNA, and only a very small proportion of people have the genetic disposition to develop these extreme abilities. Dr. James Dunn from the University of New South Wales in Australia says, "The term super recognizers was coined by researchers in 2009 in response to some of the exceptional results people were achieving on face recognition tests. In statistical terms, super recognizer describes anyone who scores two standard deviations above the average person. In other words, a person in the top 1 or 2% of the population." Dr. James Dunn said, "What we've found is that face recognition varies naturally, like IQ does. And just like IQ, it appears that a large proportion of that variance is genetically determined." We now present you an article written by researchers at the University of New South Wales in Australia under the heading, "Super Recognizers Possess Extraordinary Ability to Memorize and Recall Faces." The article has been taken from the scitechdaily.com website. Please stay with us for more. While in Paris, France in the 1990s, Georgie briefly watched a professional photographer taking pictures of kids playing in a small park near Les Halles and thought nothing of it. 10 years later, she was having breakfast in Australia's Byron Bay backpackers and asked the man next to her whether he was a photographer and if he had ever taken pictures of children playing in a Paris park. Amazed, he only said that he was and that he had. He even showed her his portfolio of the actual pictures she had witnessed him taking a decade earlier. Coincidences like these would probably go unnoticed by most of us, but Georgie has a special ability that only 2% of the world's population is endowed with. She is a super recognizer. Such people possess an extraordinary ability to memorize and recall faces of people they may have only encountered in the most unremarkable and sometimes fleeting situations, often many years before. In research published in PLOS-1, psychologists from the Forensic Psychology Laboratory at University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia, argue that the freely available University of New South Wales face test, which they have been using since 2017 to identify the world's best performing super recognizers, is a perfect screening tool to sort the good, the very good, and the exceptional face recognizers from the rest of the population. The researchers, including Dr. James Dunn, Scientia Fellow Dr. David White, and Dr. Alice Towler, say the University of New South Wales face test is able to provide more precision when it comes to ranking the abilities of super recognizers, especially when used in conjunction with existing face recognition tests, like the Glasgow Face Matching Test and the Cambridge Face Memory Test. The University of New South Wales face test was deliberately designed by the researchers to be very challenging. As a result, average performers rank at the low end of the scale. Unlike other existing tests where performance of candidates is more evenly spread across the measurement scale. Out of 31,000 people who have taken the University of New South Wales face test since 2017, nobody has ever scored 100%. The highest anyone has achieved is 97%. This means the person with the best facial recognition abilities in the world could still be out there. Dr. James Dunn says, when people do the University of New South Wales face test, they discover it's really difficult, with most people scoring between 50 and 60%. He says, but super recognizers are people who score 70% and higher. We made it difficult so that it's not too easy for the very best super recognizers, adding, when super recognizers do the traditional face test, they max out at 100%, which means it's difficult for us to differentiate between the very good and the exceptionally good. Dr. James Dunn notes, if anybody came to us thinking they may be a super recognizer, we would start them on the University of New South Wales face test and then get them to do further confirmatory tests and say, you need to do well on all of them for us to be confident that you're a super recognizer. For many years, it had been assumed that superior skills in facial recognition could be taught and would help those working in police force and security agencies to make more accurate judgments about a person's identity. While this is true up to a point, new research has found that the remarkable abilities demonstrated by super recognizers can't be learnt. Researchers think they are coded into our DNA, and only a very small proportion of the population have the genetic disposition to develop these extreme abilities. Dr. James Dunn says, the term super recognizers was coined by researchers in 2009 in response to some of the exceptional results people were achieving on face recognition tests. In statistical terms, Super Recognizer describes anyone who scores two standard deviations above the average person. In other words, a person in the top 1 or 2% of the population. Dr. James Dunn continues, "What we've found is that face recognition varies naturally like IQ does. And just like IQ, it appears that a large proportion of that variance is genetically determined." The University of New South Wales researchers are interested in super recognizers for two reasons. First of all, the more scientists learn about super recognizers and how they process faces, the more they can decode what is going on in the brain when we see both familiar and unfamiliar faces. And secondly, governments and commercial organizations are increasingly searching for people with superior face recognition abilities. Dr. James Dunn adds, "We are starting to see industries looking within and outside of their organizations for super recognizers to work in specialized face identification roles." He added, "This can include police, but may also include government and commercial bodies like immigration, intelligence agencies, security agencies, financial institutions, and even coffee shops." According to new research, there are no other common traits shared among super recognizers besides their skill itself. Super recognizers come from all walks of life and have the same spread of intelligence profiles as the general population. While many may not realize they are super recognizers, some had an inkling they were pretty good with faces at a young age. Nicole was just 11 years old when she realized she could recognize all her teacher's baby faces in a competition at her school. She says, "When everyone else was struggling to find just a couple of faces they knew, I correctly identified all 20 faces very easily. At the time, I thought it was strange, but it felt super cool too." Likewise, Wai Yin said she first realized she was a super recognizer when still a teenager. She added, "I used to look at magazines and circle people's faces instead of looking at the clothes. That's when I thought there's something weird going on." For Kelly, it wasn't until she sat at the University of New South Wales face test and was contacted by researchers that she even knew that she had the skill. But she adds, "I have always been a perfectionist and had an extremely abnormal eye for detail with everything. A lot of super recognizers start to wonder about their gift when watching television." Jessica says, "My husband and I were arguing over somebody on television looking like someone else," adding, "My husband said he thought he was pretty good at recognizing faces and Googled and found the University of New South Wales' online test. He completed it and achieved around 50%. She says, "I completed the test and had a much higher score and thought, I'm definitely better at recognizing faces than my husband. Automatic win on that topic. It wasn't until the University of New South Wales researchers contacted me that I realized my score was not within the normal range. I joined a lot of dots after that." Most see the skill as a gift that makes life more interesting or even helps in one's career. Duncan says being a super recognizer has helped in his line of work, which is recruitment. Duncan says, "People are always extremely flattered when you remember them, or if we haven't actually met in person and have only seen their picture on social media, they are usually pretty shocked. But others with the gift are a bit more cautious about exposing it." Marcus says, "It can make things quite awkward." Marcus added, "I'm quite social, so I tend to walk up to people and remember, and I soon realize they don't remember me." Sally resorts to hiding her skill. She says, "I often have to lie that I've never met or seen people before," adding, "It freaks them out. Oh, I saw you last week at Woolworths. Makes you sound like a stalker." Amanda reports a similar observation. She says, "On a daily basis, I have given up on saying things to people like, 'Hello, we were talking in the queue at Coles supermarket last week. Do you remember me?' I just got too many weird looks, and I started to feel like I was creepy sometimes, again thinking people would recognize me like I can recognize them. In the end, David says the super recognizer trait can be a mixed blessing. David added, being good at recognition comes with its own problems, feeling like the world is too small sometimes, but it has its good parts too. It's allowed me in the leisure industry to build a good rapport with customers, and I can remember every single customer. Having developed the University of New South Wales face desk to find super recognizers, the research team now plans to invite many of them into the laboratory to understand exactly why they are so super at face recognition.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله الله يا الله والحمد لله الله ولا إله
This is part of a speech of Imam Khomeini, the founder of Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with clergy and the students of the seminary. Try to reform and refine yourselves before you are enter among the people. If now, while you are unencumbered, you do not reform yourselves, on the day when people come before you, you will not be able to reform yourselves. Many things ruin people and keep them from studying and purifying themselves, and one of them for some is this very beard and turban. When the turban becomes a bit large and the beard gets long, if one has not refined oneself, this can hinder one's studies and restrict one. It is difficult to tremble the commanding self under one's feet and to sit at the feet of another for lessons. Sheikh Atusi, may Allah have mercy on him, at the age of 52, would go to classes, while between the ages of 20 and 30, he wrote some of his books. His tahdhib was possibly written during this period. Yet at the age of 52, he attended the classes of the late Sheikh Murtada, may Allah have mercy on him, and thereby achieved a similar status as he did.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. We are with the program Spring of Truth from the IRB English Radio with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini. We were talking about his viewpoints in regards to servitude and theology. In his sayings, he has said, there is God. So do not be neglectful of him. God is present. We are all under his surveillance. Now, this is what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has referred in the Quran. He says, everything is under my surveillance. We say to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala,